Mr. Farage, thank you very much for agreeing to the interview. When I told someone this evening that I was going to interview you, their immediate reaction was, oh, that's a sort of the nice middle-class Daily Telegraph reading respectable version of the BNP. And someone else said to me, of course, and made the reference you made about the Fruit Loops and so on. You know, why do you think you attract that? Is it you personally that attracts that reaction, or is it just the party?
No. I think if you challenge consensus, whether it's in science or politics or business, all through the ages of man, the first technique is to try and laugh you off as being a bunch of nutcases. Mm-hmm. I mean, they did it to Galileo, they did it to Darwin, they did it to O'Leary from Ryanair. This is the way that it works. So to be mocked and derided because you come at something from a different perspective is not unusual. Mm-hmm. The BNP comment, I mean, whoever said that to you was completely out of date.
I think they may have been mischievous, but it was just it was their immediate reaction without even thinking that the first thing they said.
But that is a completely out of date concept that almost nobody seriously thinks anymore.
Mm-hmm. In terms of the party itself, because a few years ago you were nothing, you were going nowhere, is there still a sense, you think, that you are, you know, your pressure group? Do you actually think, you know, are you doomed to be a pressure group? You're doing well, you're getting 21-22%, you're 2% behind maybe the Conservatives.
Some pressure group?
No. Of course, the reality is, on that, you could still keep those figures and come second in 300 seats at the next election. I mean, how do you make, because I mean, it's the nature of all politics, how do you make the breakthrough? Are you near?
I mean, the significant thing about May the 2nd was that in the South, they were screaming, if you vote UKIP, you'll let Labour in. If you vote UKIP, you'll let the Lib Dems in. In parts of the North, they were screaming, if you vote UKIP, you'll let the Tories in. And actually, what happened in 150 seats on May the 2nd was, if you voted UKIP, you got UKIP. Now, you know, I'm not going to begin to pretend that under a first-past-the-post system, this is easy. It's very difficult. I mean, it's the most incredible challenge.
But do you think
to take on? But who's to say? Who is to say that we cannot, by doing what the Lib Dems did in the 80s and 90s, and building up clusters of support at district and county and unitary level, find ourselves in a position where we become serious challenges for seats in 2015? I, at the moment, genuinely still don't know the answer to that question. I mean, next year is very important for us. Mm-hmm. Not just the European elections and the momentum that could possibly cause, but also the fact that there are thousands more council seats up again next year as well. So you know, I mean, as you say, it's difficult to cut this and to work out where it's going to go. All I would say is, at every stage of this in the last few years, we've surprised everybody again and again and again, and I have a feeling with a bit of luck and following wind, we'll go on surprising.
How serious do you think you will be taken in terms of that vision? I'm still not sure what makes you take away from the European Union, away from the independent nation, away from saying to people, I want to give you an aspiration, I want to give you belief, I want to give you confidence, I want to give you self-pride. You know, because I mean, Thatcher would have talked about cutting the state, you know, cutting back, rolling back the state and so on. Other people have done it. I mean, they've done it, you know, for 50, 60, 70 years. Yet it comes to the point, no one ever seems to be able to do it.
No.
What can you do? And I know the sense you say, you know, I don't care.
If you want to deregulate employment regulations in the United Kingdom at the moment, especially for small companies, you cannot do so as an EU member. So, you know, was it last week another government red tape initiative? I mean, I want to put my fingers down the throat. Mm-hmm. I've been hearing this every year for 30 years, and yet we've got a parliament that is impotent and isn't capable, isn't able to deal with these things. So, you know, we are very, very determined to make the necessary changes. And yes, it's going to be hard. And yes, if you draw support from left and right, there are some other policies that might start to divide people. And I accept all of that. I completely understand that. But when it comes to things like aspiration, when it comes to things like wanting the state effectively to have less of a role in that in our lives, it's very interesting. The public opinion on those issues too is now coming in a UKIP direction.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. You know, we can't. We dare not challenge these big central tenets of the welfare state and everything else because the public will never live with it. But actually, I mean, some of the recent opinion public on this shows that only a very small percentage of people think the state should stay as big as it is. So that there are other issues on which people coming round to the UKIP type philosophy as well.
You said in your speech about you're appealing to people who haven't voted for 10, 20 years, maybe longer, who have disconnected.
Yeah.
Again, how do you make them connect then?
Well, if you look at Clegg, Miliband, Cameron, Osborne, none of them have ever had a job.
Mm.
Never had a job. They all come from extraordinary privilege. They've all gone straight from top public schools into Oxbridge, into research offices, into the House of Commons. I mean, it's all well and good having a few people like that, but what you expect to see from political leadership and from a political party is a bit more of a balanced team. And I think with UKIP, I think we're able to, and this, I'm not going to take this for granted because it might not last forever, but I think we are speaking the kind of language that ordinary people speak, and we are demonstrably of this world.
But that's an interesting term, you know, demonstrably of this world. Mm. Because you actually think the whole political class then, you know, you are convinced of that the whole political class, Labour, Liberal Democrats and so on, are completely disconnected.
Oh, yeah.
You want MPs. You want...
Yeah,
but who are you going
to... They don't even get on with people.
But are you going to say to people who want to join your party, who maybe want to be candidates, you're going to say to them, well, I want you to have dirty hands, I want you to have been through the mill, I want you to, you know, wash dishes, I want you to have done something with your life.
Yes.
I don't want you...
Yes.
I don't want you to come... But, I mean, are you saying to people...
No, what I'm saying to you is that a team, just that when you run a company, you know, you want your brilliant academics sat in the corner giving you some ideas, and you need a range of people to make a team work. And one of the problems with career politics is that almost all of them come from the same background. Mm-hmm. That's the point. Of course we're going to have academics in the UK. Of course we are. But we're also going to have plenty of people from the real world. And that's really important. That's really, really important.
So would you limit that? You say you don't want career politicians. Would you say to your people, you know, after two terms, I'm going to replace you? Because after two terms, you know, somebody's been there 8, 10 years, they have become a career politician.
Of course, and this, of course, is the problem that all idealistic movements face. That they start off with strong ideals, and as time goes by, some of those get tempered. Of course they do. I mean, look, I'm in my third blooming term as an MEP. Should I stand down and walk away? I mean, you know, I haven't thought about these things. I have thought about these things. This is a party based on conviction, just as the Labour Party was 100 years ago. And conviction really has been lacking for some time now.
Across all the parties. Mm. Can you see yourself, I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of, it's not an exact parallel, but in what happened with the Ulster Unionist Party and the Democratic Unionist Party, UUP was seen as the party of government in Northern Ireland 50 years. DUP was always seen as a pressure group, well on the right, evangelical, and described, yes, as nutters and fruitcakes. I remember people describing. And suddenly, the DUP is now the largest party. Yeah. But the DUP has had a miserable 2 years because all the problems it said, you know, we will not have, it's suddenly, because it's almost like the problems come with the power. You know, and you suddenly find yourself in a position where you as an individual can say no, with no MPs and some MEPs, that's huge numbers of councillors say, well, we wouldn't. But suddenly you become a member of that, you become a deputy prime minister, you become prime minister, you become leader of the largest party. What do you do? Isn't that when the compromise comes? You suddenly go, if I say no to this, oh, I'm out of a job, as opposed to, oh, well, I will do this for the greater good of the party. Isn't that how they all get sucked in?
You're half right. You're half right. Because...
You're compromising on that answer.
No, I'm not actually. No, you're half right because you're describing a natural process that takes place when anybody reaches power from any position, that it brings problems and difficulties. No, exactly. But you're also half not right because if we have any part in a government of this nation going ahead, we will have achieved the historic independence of this nation. We will have achieved something greater than all the rest of them have ever done. And so, you know, provided we achieve that key objective, and provided we have a British Parliament that is sovereign, that is back in charge, and where political debate in Britain is actually reinvigorated at every level, because suddenly we're talking about things over which we do have power, rather than this current mindless, oh, well, that's Europe, we can't discuss that. Well, we can't discuss farming. Nonetheless, all decided in Brussels. Well, but shouldn't we be having a debate? I mean, you know, so I think, actually, we would be very different in that sense. And if after that you get withered on the vine, so what?
Would it be required? I mean, you achieve your ultimate goal. Your ultimate goal is an independent, sovereign nation. What I mean, are you needed then?
I think the point is that on the run up to achieving that independent sovereign nation, what UKIP has been doing and evolving as is a party that doesn't just talk about who governs Britain, but talks about how that Britain could and should be governed. And that's, you know, the entire UKIP manifesto now is really about what we do after we've left. and to that extent, I think we're engaged in some very positive thinking.
In terms of Cameron, what drives him?
Rank. Position, title.
he just wanted to be Prime Minister.
Of course.
But some people might say that of you, you just want to be... You've found a bandwagon which has huge populist appeal.
I haven't found a bandwagon. And it wasn't populist when I got involved in it.
I think there's
populist? Bloody hell. When I first started talking about immigration, climate change and the European Union, this was far from being populist.
Except that point. I'm simply talking in terms of the European Union membership, you know, because Conservative Prime Ministers, and even some Labour, have talked about, oh, we want our freedom, we want this, we want that.
Because they're con men.
But
they never meant it.
But you do.
You
100%.
Yes.
You would never compromise on
that.
Never. So no. even if you find yourself offered all the baubles, you're going to say, this.
I've already given up all the baubles. I've already given up a normal, prosperous life to do this.
Do you any sense of regret about that? Would you like your old life back? Do you enjoy the freedom?
When you've made a big decision in life, and your whole life has fundamentally changed, it would be impossible not to be reflective sometimes. Mm-hmm. To think, a lot of the people I work with are now retired, are very, very wealthy people with phenomenal lifestyles, because we really were in the right place at the right time. You know, the commodities business, you know, the boom that happened with Chinese expansion and everything else, it was an amazing place to be. So you wouldn't be normal if you didn't have some thoughts about that. But on balance, do I regret it? Lord, no. I followed a belief. I followed a passion. I've helped, I think, to make something happen that everybody thought was impossible. Mm-hmm. That's worth a lot more than money.
Political, I don't like the word idols, but I mean, in terms of, I mean, you seem to have a very dismissive attitude towards the political class. In your lifetime, in terms of who may have driven you or motivated you or inspired you, have there been political figures you've...
Yes. I'm a big admirer. I was a big admirer in my mid-teens of Keith Joseph, who I thought intellectually was driving a revolution.
You said mid-teens, does that mean you're having them reflecting you no longer are?
I was then.
Oh, right, okay.
I was then, and I still, in retrospect with history, am as well. I think, yes, I think it was remarkable. I mean, it was going against an entire consensus, a post-war consensus, a complete failure. And he was going against it, and I admire him for that. I admired Thatcher for some of her leadership skills, not for others. I think there was a slight obstinacy probably in the last term on some issues. I also admired Enoch in some ways. In some ways. Although I do bitterly regret the speech he made on immigration, because it did in fact bury the issue as an intelligent debate for decades. And that was a great shame. But in a sense, you see, he was a forerunner of Joseph, wasn't he?
Yes.
In a sense, you know, the 58 resignation from the Treasury team. You know, he was beginning to think some of those ideas earlier. And it was Joseph that got them together. And yes, I am a free market, classical liberal. I'm not really a Tory at all.
You were in the Conservative Party.
Well, I was, but that was in the Keith Joseph and Thatcher years. And as I say, I used to think I was a Conservative, but now on reflection, actually, I wasn't a Conservative. I was a radical economic liberal.
Dropped in the wrong party.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, there are very few times in history where Mrs. Thatcher would have felt that comfortable in the Conservative Party. She always would have been very much on one wing of it. But yes, I was a member of it from 78 to 1990.
Did you leave because you thought it couldn't be converted?
I left because we joined the exchange rate mechanism. I felt completely betrayed. Here was a Conservative Party that wanted to sign us up to the euro.
Up until that point,
yes.
You know, were you sort of, okay, you might have had difficulties, but were you reasonably comfortable? It sounds like it was a moment of betrayal.
Huge.
But I'm saying that but sometimes when you get that moment of betrayal and you walk from a party, you become almost obstinately, you can see no good in them ever. They all stick, they're all traitors, they've all betrayed you.
Well, I haven't seen much good since. I keep looking for it. And I see the odd person trying to do good things, and you know, Ian Duncan Smith and people like that are trying very hard, and they've got briefs that they've tried to master and understand, and of course there are some good people there.
Could you ever see yourself reaching an agreement with them?
I don't think about it.
But should you think about it? Because you may have to think about it. But you may have to. In 2 years, was it 2050? 2 years. If you don't mind me saying, sometimes I like that sort of approach, but that's throwaway line. Do you not think there are people who might think, listen to an interview with you, and then you say that, and they think, he's not intact. Yeah. He's a character, but he's not entirely serious. Could that be ultimately, could you in fact oddly damage the party you love because people don't take you seriously enough?
All right, I'll give you a serious answer. Come and ask me this time next year.
Do you think it'll make a difference, even if you get an extra, I can't remember, how many MEPs have you got now?
30.
Well, does even doubling that, does it? Can you actually inside the system?
If you keep, oh, there's nothing we can do over there. No. Please don't think anything silly like that. Like we can reform the European Union or turn it round. I mean, that's not going to happen. But if UKIP was able to become the top party in the United Kingdom in the European elections, that is a political earthquake. That is a huge message that is being sent out, not just to the rest of Europe, but actually to our political classes here. And it's one that will give us such momentum that unless they seriously respond to it, then I think anything's possible.
But what do you mean by serious response? I mean, if Cameron suddenly, as you
no
say...
No more buggering about, promising us a referendum in 4.5 years' time, after a renegotiation, if he wins the election, ifs and buts.
But what does he offer then? He can't do anything before the next election.
Of course he can.
What?
Simple. You have a referendum a month before the next general election with a caretaker government in to look after that month, and then we have a proper general election as a sovereign nation.
So basically he breaks the coalition. Do you think he's the courage? Has he the courage to do that?
It doesn't look like it, does it?
No. I'm not supposed to say that, but...
It doesn't look like it.
But
to do that, you would have to break the coalition. Of course, that's true.
But you don't think he'll do it? You're shaking your head there.
I don't think you will.
Short of UKIP actually winning a general election, forming a government on its own and actually winning that election on the basis of, this is not a case we're promising you a referendum. If we win, if we are the biggest party and form the government, there will be an in-out. It's not going to be a case of 6 months of renegotiation and rethinking. It's actually the minute I walk into number 10 Downing Street, you're having an election, you're having a referendum the next day. It's that simple. For you, there's no...
Well, we've been through all the renegotiations continually over 40 years that we should wish to go through. There is no renegotiation of the key fundamental points.
How many people who probably dislike the European Union, maybe, you know, extraordinarily emotionally hostile to the European Union, how many of them are hung up on the issue of the red tape and the bureaucracy and the strange little laws, and how many of them just don't like Johnny Foreigner? You know, is there an element that that's, you know, maybe not intentionally,
but
that's what you're appealing to? They just don't like Europeans.
Clearly there are some people that feel like that, but I don't think there are very many in number.
Seriously, you think, you know, so you actually think the people who oppose the European Union actually oppose it on those grounds, even though they may not own businesses, they may not be farmers, they may not actually experience the day-to-day red tape.
It's interesting. UKIP's changed. UKIP has changed.
Has it changed to reflect the reality that you need a different type of market to win? A different type of voter? You can't just win on the visceral, emotional stuff. It has to be more. To be more intellectual.
I've often said in the past that you could tell it was a UKIP meeting in the 1990s.
Yeah.
But the Republican ties in the front row. And there's no doubt many of our early supporters hated you. Mm-hmm. Sir Patrick Moore being classic.
Yes.
Hated the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hated the Germans. Irreconcilable. A generational thing. You can't really blame some people for feeling like that. I think, you know, if you now at a UKIP meeting say, look, we're not against Europe, we're pro-Europe, we love Europe, we want the rest of Europe to be free as well, you know, you will get a book. If I showed you the early membership list of UKIP in the South, I mean, there were very few people below the rank of major who were even members. It was all the World War II generation who felt completely betrayed by Maastricht. It was predominantly ex-conservative, quite right-wing, and that's the way it was.
Had they given up on the political classes as well?
They'd given up on, they just found Major was just, they wouldn't have had him serving the drinks, you know.
But was it just on Europe, or was it just generally about running the country and, you know, the old order?
Yes, it was very much. But now UKIP isn't like that. And UKIP is now much more of an activist party, much more of an engaged party. You saw tonight people coming forward saying they want to stand and get involved and do things. And I think we're much more of a positive party than we are a negative party. And that's part of our evolution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and
yes, I've driven some of that. And I have clearly shaped the party, and I clearly, with others, made sure there's no hint of protectionism about what we do. We're global traders. I've maintained the free market ideology, the small state ideology, the fundamental libertarian ideology, albeit sane libertarianism.
Sane left, I'm
because, you know, some of it's just, you know, some of it's a bit scary. And no, I think UKIP is, I don't think UKIP is now, you know, I mean, of course I mentioned Herman Van Rompuy. I don't get howls of, if I mentioned Delors, they'd all stop,
you don't get the same reaction now. Is that disappointing, you not getting the same reaction?
No, because actually the anger, if there's an anger in UKIP, it isn't towards Europe, it's towards the political classes that have allowed this to happen and keep dissembling to us. But actually, we're not about anger anymore. We're about a different positive future for the UK.
Just very briefly, I want to go back to what I asked you earlier, you know, in view of what you've said since then. I sense an awful lot of UKIP. Is you. When people come to the meeting, when I talk to them afterwards, I mean, maybe 10, 15 people, they were talking not about UKIP policy, they talked about you, how engaging you were, how passionate you were. I mean, but no, you laugh at that. But sometimes, you know, a party, you know, is UKIP bigger than you? Have you a broad enough range of a leadership? Have you a broad enough range of policy? Because an awful lot seems to be just what you think as a person. Which is maybe, no, that's how parties run. It's your passion that's driving that. But I mean, I sometimes think, remove, I don't want you to disappear in a plane accident, but remove you from the equation.
Yeah.
What's left of UKIP?
Well, I think over 300 well-run established branches. You can't even buy that with money. Mm. That takes time to evolve and find the right people.
What is your membership, Jen Jones?
30,000. So that's not as big as I'd like, but it's still 30,000. It's growing fast. Well, look at Northern Ireland. We've got some competent people here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we may be small here. We're only 300 members here. So, you know, Northern Ireland is currently 1% of the UKIP membership, but there are some competent people. McNary's made a difference to us. Mm-hmm. You know, he's an operator. And what's key to me in UKIP Northern Ireland is that with Riley and McNary, we are very much in the wing, in the moderate wing of the debate here. And that was a worry for me, because, you know, if you're going to stick to your guns,
you
can stick to your principles of being a non-sectarian party, you have to make sure you have a leadership of the Northern Ireland group that actually reflects that point of view, and I believe that we do.
Okay, you said that, come to the last bit then, you said let's start treating Northern Ireland like a fully paid up member of the United Kingdom. Given the nature of the Assembly, given the nature of the mechanics of the Northern Ireland Assembly, let me just ask you, Bert, about Sinn Féin and government. What do you think about Sinn Féin and government? Do you think the system should be changed, or will you live with it?
Well, I think the system was... the system that we've got here was specifically designed with its massive... with its 108 members and with its mandatory coalition, and all of that was part of the price of the peace process, you know? Mm-hmm. Has it worked? Well, walking through the streets of Belfast today, great.
Would you argue that the peace process, maybe in its political manifestation, isn't working? Can't work? Does it need change? Would you be supportive of major institutional change?
We've now reached the point where there is a maturity about the peace process and where we've got to, and there is, I mean, because there are problems, and this is a hot, difficult time of the year for all sorts of reasons, and, you know, DUP are having a miserable time, and all the things we've chatted about earlier, but are we now at the point where it's right to have a talk about changing how Stormont operates and how many members it has and what the rules are for forming government? Yes.
Would you respond then to people from on the Nationalist Republican side who would say that's just coded unionist language for we don't actually want Sinn Féin in government, you want the structures changed basically to get them out?
Well, the voters can decide this, can't they? But... Is it providing effective government for Northern Ireland at the moment? I don't think most voters would think it's working quite as well as they would like.
What would provide effective government then? What's the key change you think is required that UKIP would be arguing for?
Well, I think, and I'm afraid, you know, let's go back to your previous question. Yeah. It would have to be the rights of free association to form coalition governments.
Uh-huh. So they shouldn't be mandatory then?
No, I don't think they should.
Okay. And finally, I just want to ask...
But I also think Sinn Féin has changed. Mm-hmm. I mean, the peace process has changed Sinn Féin more than it's changed anybody, actually.
Do you think Sinn Féin lost? In the long political term, do you think they lost?
It's amazing what a ministerial car can do, isn't it?
So you think, you know, in terms of just that whole 40 years of the IRA campaign to end up in government with unionists, you know, so they a huge miscalculation then?
Yes, but also events that they couldn't have predicted, such as the gold mine that was dubbed as gold. That isn't Sinn Féin's fault. That's just the way things have worked. So I don't think the, you know, I think the union is in place, but it's a question of how does Northern Ireland get better devolved government. One of the debates we're going to have in UKIP, we started this process today at lunch. One of the debates we're going to have in UKIP is what approach we're going to take to the next assembly election. You know, are we going to go in there with a radical reform platform or not? And that's going to be a debate we're going to have inside the party.
But just on unionism, you know, why do you think unionism is so divided? Because there are times that, you know, what you've seen happen to the Conservative Party over the past 10 years must remind you what's happened to the union.
Oh,
it's destructive. You know, well, why is that? I mean, do you know, is another danger that people will say to you, you know, we understand we could vote for you in the European Union election because we want out of the European Union, but we couldn't go the next stage and vote for you in the Assembly election because you're fracturing unionism, you'll allow Sinn Féin to get in. They haven't changed that much and we want them to be First Minister.
Well, I mean, of course there's a risk of that. But I mean, look, you know, in English politics, people told me even after 2009, Nigel, you've done it in a European election, you'll never do it in a domestic election. And blame me down, on May the 2nd, you did it in a domestic election, even bigger. And now they're saying, oh, yeah, but you can't do it in a general election. I mean, you know, let's see.
What's the gap in the market? In the meeting you talked about, there was a gap in the unionist market. What is that gap that UKIP is trying, that no other
number one, we're a national party.
Conservatives would argue that they're a national party.
They don't exist yet. I don't know. That isn't even a serious question.
Okay, fair enough.
You know, I mean, come on. You know, number one, we're a national party, and we are taking it seriously here, which is why we're going to field, you know, proper candidate.
Are you going to fight in every assembly seat?
Oh, that's very much our intention, yeah. But again, you know, there's going to have to be a degree of quality control and try to get all of that right. But yes, I mean, you know, they are the intentions. And I think non-sectarian politics has its place. At least I believe it should have its place. I'd like to see it have its place. That's consistent with our thinking. And as I say, I think on this big fundamental question of sovereignty, the Ulster Unionist Party believe in membership of the European Union, and the DUP. Nigel Dodds, of course, you know, I've sat on trains and talked to him, and we're at one. But his party is not sending out a very clear message. I think there is a gap in the market for us.
There was talk, you may not be aware of it, but I certainly picked it up on the ground, and this is the last question.
Yeah.
At the European election, it would be possible for UKIP and the TUV to reach a deal.
I know.
You mean you're saying that you're aware of that?
I'm very aware of that, yes.
Would you be supportive of that?
I think that whilst UKIP and the TUV would have some quite strong agreement on the European question. Mm-hmm. I think on many of the other issues, and I think the divide's maybe too great.
Yeah, so even if you could reach some agreement on Europe, it probably wouldn't be possible to continue that agreement.
I think it's difficult, but I also think it's not for me to intervene too much myself. So let these guys get on with it.
Very, very last question. UKIP Northern Ireland, it's not a separate party as such, but you believe that being maybe regional with its own assembly, it should have a large degree of autonomy.
I think they should decide exactly how they think education should be shaped in Northern Ireland. I think they should decide here how education should be shaped in Northern Ireland without me bossing them around. I think they should be able to make their own minds up about the TUV and what do. Rather than us telling them centrally what they ought to be doing or not to be doing, I'd rather give them the broad brush principles of where we want to go and what we want to do and let them get on with it. And if I feel they're getting it wrong, I'll intervene.
So that would that be your be approach to the UKIP across the UK then?
Yes,
it just takes it back to what you said earlier when I said, you know, it's conviction seems to be driven very much by you. Given that the nature of regional devolution and the differences, do you think you can get a coherent policy where the Scottish UKIP might want to do one thing on education, the Northern Ireland UKIP would have different views on abortion, for example,
provided they stick within the big broad brush principles of support for selective education and a belief that too many ologies are coming, I blame more of them for all of this, but too many ologies are coming at the price of trades and skills, provided it's within those frameworks, yes. You know. And I mean, I'm not some sort of dictator or ogre or far from it. I'm actually quite relaxed about all of this.
Yes, I get the impression.
You know, and I trust people until they let me down.
Yeah, you're fatalistic. Yeah.
Oh, completely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, completely. Completely.
But that drives you as well, doesn't it? Is it that sense of, you know, but for the grace of whatever you believe in, you may not have been here?
Oh, I've had three goes at that. One major road traffic accident, cancer, and an aeroplane crash, so I'm still here.
You have nothing to lose by keeping on fighting.
No, and actually, I think I'm getting somewhere. Mm-hmm. We are changing the debate in British politics. Mm-hmm. We really are. It's terribly exciting.
You're happy?
Yeah.
You look like a happy man.
Yeah.
You look like a man who's hit the right buttons at the right time.
Yeah. Most of life, actually, is about right place, right time, isn't mm-hmm. it? It far outweighs ability.
And the quality of your opponents, where there's a very
good sense,
which I think has helped you enormously. Oh. There is this groundswell of opinion that, as you say, you personally think the political class are hopeless, but I think that's a sense that's sweeping through. Mm.
It's a terribly exciting time.
Thank you.
All right,
very much.
Thank you. Lovely.